I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Biden thanked Justice Stephen Breyer for his, quote, remarkable career of public service at a ceremony at the White House yesterday, where Breyer announced his retirement from the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of the court's current term. Breyer is 83 years old, currently the oldest member of the court, nominated by President Clinton back in 1994. Breyer has been described as a pragmatic centrist who looks for compromise, although he often sides with the liberals on the court. We asked Theodore Ruger to join us. He's dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He's also the Bernard G. Siegel Professor of Law, and he clerked for Justice Breyer from 1997 to 1998. And Ted Ruger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me ask you just a couple of personal questions. What was it like to clerk for Justice Breyer?
Oh, well, it was certainly a career highlight and a wonderful experience. You know, Justice Breyer is a former professor of law, and he kind of brought that almost teaching style and curiosity into the chambers. We would work with he worked with all the clerks together on all the cases, which is different than some other justices and judges on other courts would kind of delegate a particular case to a particular clerk. The Supreme Court justices have four clerks each. But rather than working individually, he would kind of almost come out into the larger room where the clerks worked and almost treat it like an academic seminar a few weeks before each case. We'd kind of talk it through, and he used to like to read the cases early, several weeks before argument, and then he would kind of direct us on certain research ideas he had, like things he wanted to learn more about. So it was very, very, very much a kind of vibrant academic experience in his chambers.
Did he pal around with his clerks? Was it all business, some combination of the two?
He was. You know, it was very professional, but when we would talk, he had a range of interests. You know, kind of he loved you know, kind of to travel the world and meet with judges in other countries, particularly countries that didn't have our tradition of long judicial independence, and so we were often working with him on his travels and thinking about judges in other countries and supporting them. He loved you know, we would talk about food and restaurants that he liked. He wasn't as much of a sports fan. I think one time he told us, you know, he was happy that, like, the Celtics were in the Super Bowl or something like that. He kind of mashed together a couple of his Boston teams. But he was, you know, he was really a great boss to work for. And I think, spent a lot of time with us talking about issues of the day outside the cases.
I described him and others have as a pragmatic centrist. Does that fit him, do you think, Ted?
So it's, you know, there's no question that's one of many things that fits him. I guess I would emphasize that the pragmatism was informed by just a real curiosity and respect for facts about the world. So there's, I think, no justice in history who read more and cited more medical journals, scientific journals, economic journals. He really wanted to know. He really cared about the place of the court in our complex society and the impact that its decisions would have. And so he researched that. He didn't just look at the law cases as he did, but he also informed his analysis with the insights from other disciplines, which you know, made his he was very aware of the effect that the decisions might have, and he brought that into his jurisprudence. So sometimes and often that did produce pragmatism, because he really listened to the consequences and arguments on both sides. But I think he started first with the principle that he ought to be aware, and every justice should, of the impact that the court has and that different decisions would have.
Let me play a clip from it's a speech. It was actually a virtual lecture he gave at Harvard Law School. This was last April, part of their annual Scalia lecture series. His speech titled The Authority of the Court and the Peril of Politics. It was turned into a book. But here's just a section where he talks about the importance of the public maintaining trust in the U.S. Supreme Court.
I'm an optimist. The rule of law has weathered many threats, but it remains sturdy. I hope and expect that the court will retain its authority. But that authority, like the rule of law, depends on trust, a trust that the court is guided by legal principle, not politics. Trust in the courts requires knowledge. It requires understanding. In a word, it requires work. Work on the part of all citizens. And we must undertake that work together.
Ted, and again, you know, reading about Justice Breyer, this word optimism comes up, and he describes himself as an optimist. Where do you think that comes from?
I think, you know, it would have started as a young boy and an Eagle Scout in San Francisco, kind of taking advantage of all the opportunities that growing up in the United States offered him. Then through his life, kind of, I think being fulfilled by, you know, intellectual inquiry and just working with others and he really did have a faith in American institutions. As I said, he viewed it as our greatest export product. He would go around the world talking to and really supporting judges in newer democracies. And he used to say, you know, what the secret to judicial independence is a good constitutional structure plus about 100 years. and he was well aware that you can't just, you know, that, but he really wanted to support burgeoning judiciaries in places like Russia and Brazil and Colombia and others, places where he spoke, he really cherished the independence of the judiciary here.
He also said, and I guess wrote in this book, once appointed, a judge naturally decides a case in the way that he or she believes the law demands. It's a judge's sworn duty to be impartial, and all of us take that oath very seriously. I've also seen a number of people describing him as a hopeless romantic. There was an article today, I think it was in the New York Times, the willful naivete of Stephen Breyer. Does that seem fair to you?
No, I don't think that's fair. I mean that suggests a disregard or naivete about politics, and I think he was quite sophisticated. He was an optimist, and he believed in working with justices appointed by Republican and Democratic presidents. It was quite interesting. A few times his chambers were near Justice Kennedy's, and a few times a year, and this is quite rare at the Supreme Court, those two justices, you know, Justice Kennedy would walk over and go into Justice Breyer's chamber and close the door. And, you know, that's of course, we never knew exactly what was said, but I know that the relationship was there. And it was one of, you know, it was not one of naivete. It was one of kind of sophisticated shared understanding and working toward a common result. And that, you know, that characterized a lot of the most important work that Justice Breyer and Justice Kennedy did.
What do you think his, I mean, he's still on the court. He's going to be there until the end of this term. What, though, do you think his legacy will be, his mark on the court and maybe on our lives, the fact that he sat on the court for almost 30 years?
I think his legacy will be, you know, in a way of thinking about the law more so than in sort of landmark decisions. He never served as the key vote, and most of the time on split decisions, he wasn't in the majority, but he brings to the law somewhat like, say, a Richard Posner, who never made it to the Supreme Court, a way of looking at law in terms of expertise from other fields, in terms of real-world consequences of decisions that is really influential. It's influenced a lot of judges. There's an interesting analog with another brilliant justice with whom he served, Antonin Scalia, who likewise, whose methodology never commanded a majority. You know, Scalia was a textualist and, you know, was brilliant at that. He never quite got the court majority, neither did Justice Breyer, but both justices have really influenced the way legal scholars think about cases and lower court judges decide cases. Their influence is felt in their brilliance, in the way that their methodologies, I think, will live on more so than in landmark cases where they were the key vote.
I thought it was interesting yesterday at the White House, at the ceremony where he announced his retirement. What he talked about was that the United States, our form of government, is still an experiment. Was that something that he said often? An experiment that is, you know, that is still being experimented with.
Yeah, I mean, I think look, in many ways, he's the most patriotic person I've ever spent any time around. He loves
really?
This country. He loves this country and loves our government and really believes in it. And that is separate and apart from politics. So, again, that's not naivete to me. That's a certain abiding patriotism that, and I do think I've probably never worked with or been around somebody who was more of a patriot than the justice.
That's a pretty profound statement.
Yeah, I think, I mean, again, it comes from, and I, of course, I didn't know him when he was younger, but through his whole life, he loves this country, he believes in the institutions, and he is an optimist, and he's an optimist that thinks, you know, is aware of risks, but he's very much mm-hmm. believes in this country.
I was looking at an interview he did with Judy Woodruff, I think it was sometime last year, where he said she was asking him about his, you know, when he would retire. And one of the things he did say was, I don't want to die on the court. Is there anything we should make of the timing of his announcement, his decision to retire?
Well, I mean, I actually hadn't heard that phrase, which is sort of poignant. But I feel like what's clear that when I worked with him 20 years ago and now, he has a rich life outside the court. And actually, he would, you know, as a father, as a grandfather, as a, you know, somebody with interests in, you know, of course, he used to enjoy riding his bike. Now he enjoys walking. And, you know, it just and it got deep interest in reading, literature, travel. So he has a, you know, there's certainly the notion that he's going to have a rich life after he retires with other interests, and that would be important to him, certainly rings true.
Nina Totenberg had a lovely profile of him where she talked about a number of bike accidents. I don't know, Ted Ruger, if you can talk about that or not, but I thought, what a wonderful thing to know about a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, it's remarkable, both Justice Breyer and many of the other justices certainly used to, and you know, the way that they put it this way, they commute to work like the rest of us on their own. You know, very mm-hmm. few of them have at least or had drivers or special security, and so and they would have parking spots, and Justice Breyer at that time lived in a different part of D.C., and occasionally his secretary would tell the clerks, oh, he's biking in today, and we'd all get a little nervous until we saw him, but because that was after a few of the bike accidents. But, you know, it's to the point of he didn't come in a limousine. He would get to work by himself, either driving or biking, and, you know, kind of mm-hmm. when he was not at the court, enjoyed walking around Washington, D.C. or Boston or different cities in the world where he traveled, very much kind of exploring life as a citizen.
Well, Ted, we got to leave it there. And thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. That's Ted Ruger. He's the dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and he clerked for Justice Breyer from 97 to 98. Justice Breyer announced his retirement yesterday, and his retirement, which will be official at the end of the court's term. Much more about Justice Breyer and the Supreme Court after this short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Justice Stephen Breyer made it official yesterday at a ceremony at the White House announcing his retirement from the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of the current term. President Biden also made a campaign promise official yesterday, announcing his choice to replace Breyer on the court.
I will select a nominee worthy of Justice Breyer's legacy of excellence and decency. While I've been studying candidates' backgrounds and writings, I've made no decision except one. The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first Black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. It's long overdue, in my view. I made that commitment during the campaign for president, and I will keep that commitment.
Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the Senate will move quickly to fill the seat as soon as possible. The Democrats need just 51 votes to approve Biden's nominee, although this being such a partisan body, it's hard to imagine it will be smooth sailing for whomever the president picks. Well, today on Radio Times, Breyer's legacy, Biden's announcement, and the future of the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us is Lisa Tucker. She's Associate Professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Lisa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Great to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. And also with us is Jeffrey Rosen, and he is CEO and president of the National Constitution Center, also a professor of law at George Washington University Law School. And Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be back.
Nice to have you both back. And let me just make sure our listeners can join us on Radio Times. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We could spend the rest of the hour talking about Justice Stephen Breyer, but I do want to make sure that we talk about these various names that are being floated and also the future of the court and also how partisan these nominations have been. But Jeffrey, let me begin with you. How should we remember, and he's still on the court, but how should we remember Justice Stephen Breyer?
Well, Dean Ruger did such a beautiful job at summing up the essence of his pragmatic patriotism. And this idea of being a pragmatist was embodied in the beautiful words that Justice Breyer gave at the White House yesterday. He said what he most enjoyed doing was talking to high school students and college students. And the reason it was such a thrill was because, as his mother used to say, in America, it's every race, it's every religion, it's every point of view possible. It's kind of a miracle when you sit there and think all of these different people are so different, but they're resolving their differences under law. And that vision of bringing together people from different perspectives to listen respectfully to each other, to deliberate and to compromise, was one that he embodied on the Supreme Court. His greatest legacy, as Dean Ruger said, may have been behind the scenes as much as in his majority opinions. But it was really Breyer who helped bring the compromises possible that led to the upholding of the Affordable Care Act. He worked with Justice Kagan and Chief Justice Roberts, two other pragmatic centrists, to come up with a compromise that ended up upholding the act. And that was typical of his vision. I had the great pleasure of interviewing him for a National Constitution Center online civics class that we teach every week last spring. It's for high school students. Yeah. And I asked him, you know, what have you learned in your years on the bench? And he paused and he said, well, that I have less power to persuade people than I thought, which was really, really interesting.
Yep.
But then he said what he was still optimistic that if you take time to listen to someone and say, friend, what do you think, that compromise, deliberation, and pragmatic accommodation really were possible. That sense of optimism, far from being naive, I think Dean Ruger was absolutely right to reject that thesis, was deeply American, deeply Madisonian, and really unique at this polarized time when both the left and the right are so attached to rigid ideologies of the Constitution and of politics, that decent, kind, temperate, moderate Madisonian pragmatism is just very precious and will be very greatly missed.
Well, indeed. And Lisa, let me get you in on the conversation as well. How should we remember Justice Stephen Breyer? If he had, you know, how did he impact, you think, our lives?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that some of the things Jeff is saying are right on. I mean, first of all, he was on the court for a long time, more than 27 years. And in that time, the court decided a lot of cases that were really critically important to American society. Cases on the First Amendment, on gun rights, on abortion, on the death penalty. And I think something that's so interesting about Justice Breyer, and something that I think we can all take a page out of his book, is that he wasn't one of the justices that was sort of out there trying to get people to notice him. You know, there's a famous story in which David Souter, who served on the court with Justice Breyer, was in, I think, a restaurant or a truck stop or something like that. And some people came up to him and said, "You're on the Supreme Court, right?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And they said, "You're Justice Breyer, right?" And Souter actually said, "Well, yes, I am," because he didn't want to correct them. And then they said, "What's the best thing about serving on the Supreme Court?" And he said, "Well, you know, I think it would have to be serving with David Souter."
That's a great
story. These two guys who were sort of older, balding white guys mistaken for each other and didn't really have any vanity about that. He wanted to get the work done. He wanted to, I loved it yesterday in his address when he held up the pocket constitution and said, "This is what it's all about." And really bringing things back to American and democratic ideals. That's what I think we saw from him. And, he certainly will be tough shoes to fill.
Well, indeed. Let me play another clip. And again, this is Justice Breyer. He gave a virtual lecture at Harvard Law School. This was last April. The speech titled "The Authority of the Court and the Peril of Politics," again, I believe turned that speech into a small book. But here he is talking about the public perception of the court as a political body. Let's play it, and then we'll talk about it, and then we'll move on.
If the public sees judges as politicians and rogues, its confidence in the courts and in the rule of law itself can only diminish. Diminishing the court's power, including its power to act as a check on other branches.
Well, let me start with you, Jeffrey. I mean, I think a lot of people do see the court in political terms.
They do indeed. And that's why Justice Breyer recognized that public legitimacy is so fragile. He thought it was up to the court to avoid splintering on 6-3 or 5-4 ideological lines in order to maintain public confidence. He looked to history to say that that was all the court had. He, quoting the famous Hamilton, that the court has neither purse nor sword. It only depends on public legitimacy. And that's why it was such a delicate line that he was walking. On the one hand, he insisted that judges don't decide cases based on pure politics. He told our National Constitution Center high school students, "Your political philosophy may influence you. If you believe that free enterprise or socialism are necessary for the salvation of the country, that might influence your point of view, but it's never an effort to help one political party or another." But on the other hand, he recognized that in certain cases where justices have really strong views, like abortion and gun rights and vaccine mandates, they may be unable to separate their political philosophy from their constitutional conclusions. So that's why it's a nuanced philosophy that can't be put on a bumper sticker, but it really has a lot to do with the self-restraint of both citizens and justices and politicians. Basically, it's a vision of moderation, saying that unless the institutions themselves act in a way that maintains public trust, then citizens won't believe in the rule of law. And that's the core of the republic. That's why Lisa's so right. It's so moving. Holding up the Constitution reminds us, without citizens actually willing to obey decisions that they don't agree with, then we go the way of ancient Greece or Rome or modern autocracies. So this is a very serious civics lesson that Breyer is not only teaching us, but living. And he recognizes that it's fragile and that it depends on all of us as citizens, justices, and congresspeople to maintain this very delicate balance.
Well, inspiring words and very timely as well. Well, let's move on to talk about President Biden, who said this was a campaign promise and he made good on it yesterday without naming names. I'll put this to you, Lisa Tucker. He's going to nominate a black woman for the court. I'm thinking of Ronald Reagan, number of decades ago, who said, "I'm going to put a woman on the court." How significant is this?
I think it's huge, Marty. I think it's huge because President Biden recognizes, I think, what Jeff was just talking about, the public's confidence in the court and the public's confidence in the rule of law and what a fragile thing that is. And how much the court represents, a representation of American society. There's never been a black woman on the court. There have only been two African-American people on the court, both men. And putting a black woman on the court, is optics as well as, there's no question. Biden said yesterday, this person is going to have character. This person is going to have credentials. This person is going to have experience and integrity. And knowing that he has so many options in black women of people who will embody all of those characteristics, all of those criteria, and at the same time be able to show that to the country. Look at the rich diversity we have in our country of incredibly qualified people. And I'm hoping, and Jeff, you know, with the pandemic and all, you and I haven't gotten to talk much in the last couple of years, but, you know, this is something that's very, very important, the legitimacy of the court. And I think this will go a long way. What do you think?
Yeah, what do you think, Jeff?
Absolutely. No question about it. I miss our conversations in person too, Lisa. And
well, it's nice to have you on the radio together where we can all listen in. But go ahead, Jeff.
Thanks for bringing us together, sure. Marty, virtually. But as Lisa says, if Breyer is right, and we agree that he is, that this legitimacy is a fragile thing, having a court that looks like America is a crucial part of this legitimacy. And at a time when half the country is believing that the court doesn't represent its views and public confidence in the court has plummeted from almost 60% in 2020 to, close to the bottom 40s now. And at a time when the court this term may polarize further by overturning or severely narrowing Roe v. Wade and embracing a new vision of gun rights and next term confronting affirmative action. It's all the more important that people have confidence in the justices representing people like them, not in a sense of reading the polls like politicians, but of maintaining public legitimacy in a country that, as Justice Breyer said, is full of people of different races, religions, ethnicities, and political points of view.
Well, let me get political here. I mean, it's clear, Lisa, that Republicans are already, you know, I'm sure digging into people's backgrounds. Mitch McConnell said he didn't want a radical on the court. And the names that have been floated out there, no one looks like a radical in my estimation. But how much do you think this is going to be a bruising fight?
I think it's going to be bruising in one sense and not in another. As you noted at the top of the show, Marty, there are, 51. We do have the 51 Democratic votes. And presuming that nothing, tragic happens, losing a senator in some way before a confirmation hearing, it seems likely that this nominee will be able to be confirmed on numbers only, and certainly based on the short list on qualifications as well. But I'm nervous for whoever this nominee is. We know that this is a very fractured country. We know that it's in many ways still a racist country. And the intersectionality of having a black woman when both of those groups, tend to be criticized and very unfairly, I think this could be really, really difficult. And we're going to hear a lot of things that aren't fair and aren't pleasant. And I hope that people will push back against that.
Well, and Jeffrey, let me just raise a sort of semi-related issue having to do with this whole process of nominating someone for the Supreme Court. This is something that a president gets to do from time to time. But as we all remember, when President Obama wanted Merrick Garland at least to have a hearing, Mitch McConnell refused to have a hearing, saying, no, the next president gets to decide. I think Obama had something like 9 months left on his term. And then, of course, near the end of President Trump's term, Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies, and he selects someone, Comey, to sit on the court. And all of a sudden, the rules that defined what Obama did not apply to Trump. Now, I'm not being naive here, but just the sort of the gamesmanship that has come to define so much of this nomination process is very worrisome. I wonder what you think.
Well, in a purely descriptive sense, and of course the National Constitution Center is nonpartisan, so all I can do is describe what's going on. You can't get a justice confirmed to the Supreme Court if you're a president unless you hold the Senate. Mm-hmm. That's where we are right now. The Senate were Republican, President Biden wouldn't get his nominees through. And if a Republican president faced a Democratic Senate, same thing. So there are these windows of opportunity to confirm justices. Justice Breyer was certainly aware of that. You asked, about the timing of his retirement. And right. He's a highly sophisticated public servant and student of American history. So he wanted to give the president plenty of time to get his nominee through. And that's why Lisa's absolutely right that in the end, this nominee will be confirmed, and the Republicans are just going to have to decide how much of a fuss they want to make about it and how much political capital, if any, they want to risk, because the outcome is preordained, just as that of Justices Barrett and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh basically were. So I won't. I'll leave it to others to say whether this is a good or bad thing. But well, I guess I can say, Jeffrey.
Go ahead.
As a student of history, we can say that this is a new thing. It was not. The case that there were a couple of very closely divided confirmations in the 19th century decided by one or two votes, but it wasn't the norm. And now the norm is that you can't get any votes from senators from the other party. And that was not the framers' understanding. They had in mind advice and consent where there'd be deliberation and thoughtful solons would offer input and would choose the best people for the job, and that's not where we are right now.
No, it isn't. And at least we're almost up on a break, but let me just ask you the question, but just frame it slightly differently. Did what Mitch McConnell did that hurt the court? Did it hurt the court process?
You want me to answer?
I do. Yes, go ahead, Lisa.
Sorry, I didn't know it was me. Yes, absolutely. I think it hurt the court process for exactly some of the reasons we've been talking about, that the American public sees this as gameplay and as political and not about choosing someone who's going to be a very serious jurist who really takes the law and the Constitution seriously. Yes.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We're going to talk about some of the names that have been floated to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. That's Lisa Tucker. She's associate professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Jeffrey Rosen is with us as well, CEO and president of the National Constitution Center, which is right across the street from us here in Philadelphia. Also a professor of law at George Washington University Law School. And as always on Radio Times, we want your questions, your comments, your reactions. This is the U.S. Supreme Court, a critical decision that a president gets to make, and of course, the Senate gets to decide. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with our guests about the fact that Justice Stephen Breyer is retiring from the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of the court term. We've been talking about his tenure on the court, his legacy. We've been also talking a bit about the politics of Supreme Court nominations and the future of the court itself, its reputation, and, of course, who President Biden might pick to replace Breyer. Let me put a couple of names out there. And Lisa, let me start with you. The name that seems to be on the top of a lot of people's lists is Ketanji Brown Jackson. She's on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. She was a law clerk for Breyer. I believe she was a public defender as well. What do we need to know about her?
Well, I should start off by saying, Marty, that Judge Jackson is a very close friend of mine since law school. In fact, Dean Ruger and Judge Jackson and I all went to law school together. Obviously, I'm a little biased here, but I think, you know, somebody who's unbiased will see that she's just unbelievably qualified. She served on the district court for a number of years, 8 years, I think. She was very easily confirmed to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals about 6 months ago. And to me, that's a really key factor. As Jeff mentioned, it's the most important criteria right now is who can be confirmed by the Senate. And yes, indeed, given the majority in the Senate, it seems like it's a done deal. But the fact that Judge Jackson was confirmed last June by this Senate, this same Senate, and in fact even got some Republican votes back then, I think will make her a very, very attractive nominee to the White House, because maybe some of the, you know, political stuff that we've been talking about will be a little bit more low key. And it's hard to imagine how they could say she was qualified then and is not qualified now.
Hmm. Jeff, anything you want to add to that?
Absolutely. The coolest thing that I participated in with one of the last times I saw Lisa was when Judge Jackson came to the National Constitution Center for a panel on Hamilton, the man, the musical, and the law, with Vanessa Nadal, who is Lin-Manuel Miranda's wife. And it was an amazing discussion with the three of them.
And an attorney.
And a brilliant attorney and scholar of history. And they were joined by Dean Erwin Chemerinsky from Berkeley. And the Radio Times listeners, check out the video on the website. Just Google Hamilton and Judge Jackson in the NCC. But Judge Jackson's passion for history, her love of Hamilton and her judicious spirit and her brilliance were very much in effect. Just in the spirit of even-handedness, I have to say that the other leading candidate to replace Justice Breyer, Justice Leandra Kruger of California, also appeared in a National Constitution Center symposium, which we held at GW Law School, about the history of Supreme Court clerkships. And she talked about clerking for Justice John Paul Stevens, Justice Jackson clerked for Justice Breyer, and was also absolutely brilliant in that experience. So learn more about these great nominees by going to constitutioncenter.org and watch
you
the
You always
videos.
Do that, Jeff. You're very good at promoting the National Constitution Center. Part of your job. I get it. And Leandra Kruger, she's a judge of the Supreme Court in California. She has, Lisa, argued numerous cases, as I understand it, before the U.S. Supreme Court. Let me ask you, is it important that a Supreme Court justice have that kind of have courtroom experience, have either been a defense attorney or a prosecutor? Is that important?
Well, you know, many of them have. Some of them have not. And in fact, you know, the trend for a while was law professors were getting appointed, you know, Justice Breyer being a perfect example. I will say that, you know, Justice Kruger was in the Solicitor General's office and rose to pretty much the highest post beneath the Solicitor General, him or herself. I'm sort of an avid court person. I call myself a court junkie. And, you know, this is my Super Bowl right now. You know, Breyer retires. Oh, my gosh, this is the most exciting thing. And, you know, so I spend a lot of time at the court. And back when you could actually go and watch arguments there, I was there for another argument many years ago. And Leandra Kruger was arguing what I think was maybe her second argument before the court. And I turned to the person sitting next to me and said, oh, my God, who is this? Oh, wow. Because she was so unbelievably good. And to be good at that is just an incredibly difficult skill. You have to understand how to talk to the justices. You have to understand the kinds of questions that the justices are interested in and really where the legal nuances lie. Now, I will say that the idea of a prosecutor or a defender, the idea of a public defender being on the Supreme Court is something that a lot of people are talking about. And of course, Judge Jackson has that background. That would be something much more unusual. So, you know, certainly it's an asset, but it's not a requirement. But there are a lot of people who think, you know, it would be cool to see somebody who's been on the other side of the criminal justice process in there.
Well, here's another name that's been floated. Jeff, I'll put this to you. J. Michelle Childs. She is, I believe, a South Carolina federal judge. And I also think she's got a hearing for a different job next week in Washington, D.C. I know Representative Clyburn supports her. She is from South Carolina. Jeff, she did not go to the Ivy League the way a lot of Supreme Court justices did. Is that important?
Well, as you say, it is to Senator Clyburn and to some other senators, and they argue that we've got too many Ivy Leaguers and that it would be good to have a Judge Childs who holds undergraduate and graduate degrees from state schools in Florida and South Carolina, excellent state schools, but not Harvard and Yale, and that Representative Clyburn has also said that just as Joe Biden was brought up in Scranton and Delaware, educated in public schools, that's who Michelle Childs is. So it just reminds us, Lisa was really thoughtfully talking about the unique perspective of having a public defender for the first time on the court, the idea of having someone with Judge Child's background, having served on the U.S. District Court in South Carolina for over a decade, is also has strong political backers. And this is talking about the Supreme Court Super Bowl, as Lisa said, is right. This is all a lot of behind the scenes politics and people pushing their candidates and weighing these different considerations.
Lisa, as I understand it, all the justices on the court now are either Catholic or Jewish. Is it important to have someone who's not Catholic or Jewish? Does that make a difference?
Wow, that's a great, I hadn't even thought about that. That's so interesting. You know, as we've been saying all through this, different perspectives only add more contributions to, you know, seeing the law perhaps or seeing life experience in different ways. You know, I would think that would be low on the list of the criteria that President Biden is looking for. I think much more important to President Biden is probably the age of the nominee. All of these women are relatively young, but one of the goals, of course, is to make sure that whomever he appoints is in that seat for decades. So I think that Judge Childs might be the oldest of the three at 56, I think. But that's, you know, that's still a bit relatively young, with Justice Kruger being only 46. And that would be almost record making in terms of age. But you really want to have somebody on there that's going to be on there for a long, long time and be able to grow as a justice, be able to build those relationships. And of course, you know, be able to, you know, make law that's going to last for generations.
A couple of other names I'll just float in, and there might be, I'm sure there are others as well. Jeff, I saw Sherrilyn Ifill might have been on someone's short list. She's of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Holly Thomas, the Ninth Circuit Court, a civil rights attorney. Anything we should know about them or any other names that we should know about that we should at least get a thumbnail sketch of?
All extraordinarily accomplished lawyers, and Sherrilyn Ifill was on the National Constitution Center Board of Trustees and is one of the most distinguished civil rights attorneys in America. And all of these candidates are great. People are putting names forward, and President Biden said he'll choose someone by the end of the month.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about the nomination process. And Jeff, I'll go back to you. And you know, if people watch, you can see for some it is this sort of game of cat and mouse, you know, as these nominees are being asked certain questions. And you see members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, you know, trying to score points one way or the other. What should we look for to really get to the heart of the matter?
You know, I have always been an evangelist for the view that it's worth closely watching confirmation hearings. The conventional view is they're just kabuki theater. That's the cliche, and that senators ask, you know, political questions and the nominees evade them, and it's just a show. But if you go back and read the transcripts of confirmation hearings, you find that the candidates actually reveal their judicial philosophies in very specific ways. Huh. Justice Breyer, in his confirmation hearings, signaled extremely precisely his pragmatism in words almost identical to the ones that he used at the White House yesterday when he talked about making the law work for ordinary people and making the institutions of government function as in a practical way. Justice Souter expressed his admiration for Justice William Brennan, signaling the evolution that would lead him to become a liberal lion. Justice Gorsuch talked about his originalism and so forth. So, you know, they're long, of course, and maybe a more effective way to do it is to read the transcripts after. But if any listeners have the fortitude for a little bit of homework, take the hearing seriously, maybe read the transcripts after they come out, and we'll get a good sense of what kind of judicial philosophy these nominees have. And that's the most important question before the country. What kind of justice will they be? And we're likely to learn something about that in these hearings.
Our listeners are tossing out Kamala Harris, Anita Hill, you know, some people. I'll just leave those out there because I don't believe that they are on President Biden's list. Let me turn to you, Lisa. We're talking about a largely or certainly majority conservative court. So whoever replaces Breyer will be, you know, with the two other, I guess, liberal justices. Do you think they'll make a difference on the court one way or the other?
Well, I think there are a couple of ways it makes a difference. I think the first is that having that voice in the room is something that Justice Breyer really modeled for us, and how important those conversations among justices are. Sometimes you don't see it, the results of that conversation in this case, but maybe 10 years from now, they are still talking about the issue and some justices have changed their minds. The other thing that happens is, you know, if this seat stays a Democratic seat, a liberal seat, then, you know, again, that person's going to be there for a long time. And, you know, there's the potential to be adding more people to that branch. That's why the death of Justice Ginsburg was so momentous and pivotal, because it really actually did change ideologically that seat. So, you know, I don't think this is something that's going to make a real short-term difference. I think there's a lot of potential for it to make a long-term difference. And, you know, just to jump off of something that Jeff said, Jeff, I want to talk about this more with you sometime, because to me, the confirmation hearings, you know, somebody used the phrase kabuki dance for the confirmation hearings, that they're very formalistic, that they're really a chance for the senators to kind of talk, that the nominees actually don't say anything of moment. And of course, they're so rigorously prepped by the White House to make sure that they don't say anything that could be construed one way or another. So I love this idea of reading the transcripts. And, you know, maybe I'm going to change my mind about this.
Fair enough.
We can read them together.
You heard that on Radio Times. Let's look ahead. I mean, you know, this is a really important series of months, Jeff, ahead for the Supreme Court. You've got abortion, affirmative action. You mentioned guns. There are obviously other cases and issues as well. And Breyer will be on the court, so he will be there to hear the arguments one way or the other. Based on your sort of reading of the tea leaves and looking at Roe v. Wade and the future of abortion rights in this country, do you see that, if not going away, being diminished?
Well, the first thing to say is that the court has almost certainly decided the abortion case already. So Breyer may have decided that he's done all he can, and the decision will be out by June. I'm not going to venture to predict. People above my pay grade can presume to figure out what the court will do, but it is an extraordinarily challenging position for Chief Justice John Roberts, who wants to maintain the legitimacy of the court and has signaled a reluctance to overturn Roe cleanly, but is also open, as the other justices at the oral argument seem to be, to changing the point at which abortions are permitted. So, you know, all we can say is this is a watershed moment. And what did Justice Breyer say in the oral arguments? This is a good time to remember that.
Sure.
He read out loud a selection from Planned Parenthood v. Casey, talking about the legitimacy of the court. And with great emotion in his voice, he said that, here's the sentence he read, to overrule under fire, in the absence of the most compelling reason, to re-examine a watershed decision would subvert the court's legitimacy beyond any serious question. Mm-hmm. And then after that quotation, Breyer added, once the public concludes that justices are just political, you're just politicians, that's what kills us as an American institution. Very strong words from such a temperate justice. And he recognized the stakes, and he was challenging his colleagues not to drive the court over a cliff.
Well, that's the perfect place to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And he is the CEO and president of the National Constitution Center, which is here in Philadelphia. In fact, right across the street from WHYY. He's also professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. Lisa Tucker, as always, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's going to be an interesting spring.
It sure is. And she is associate professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law on the other side of town in West Philadelphia. Go to WHYY.org. You can look up Radio Times under programs. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to this hour and many, many more hours of Radio Times. It's all there for you. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.